Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program, the city of Johannesburg says it's not in crisis, but can 5 days of cash really be called a turnaround? Digital ID promises faster government, but could it hand the state a new tool of control? 6 in 10 school principals say they are ready to quit, so who's going to be left to run South Africa's classrooms? And fuel prices are not just hurting motorists, they are reshaping small businesses and the big taxi economy. It's Monday, the 6th of July. Now, is the city of Johannesburg really turning a corner, or is it simply putting a more optimistic frame around a very difficult set of numbers? Let me explain. The city of Johannesburg says its third quarter results show measurable progress, stronger revenue collection, improved financial indicators, and also a credible turnaround. But critics are pointing to weak cash coverage, a huge debtors book, and ongoing pressure, increasing pressure on basic services. So let's test the argument now. And I'm in conversation with Tebogo Moroka, who is Chief Financial Officer at the City of Johannesburg. Tebogo, a very warm welcome. And let me start here. When residents hear or see reports that the city has only 5 days of cash to cover a 30-day target, why should they not call this a crisis?
Look, I think why it shouldn't be called a crisis is that the City of Johannesburg continues to meet some of its key obligations. Yes, there is pressure. I mean, you would have seen some of our engagements with Eskom in the main. But I think those, what we have done is to structure them a bit differently with our engagements to Eskom, because we know what the key issues are in that entity and how those entities have manifested itself over the years, and we need to fix that. But I mean, I can't run away, Jeremy, when I speak to you of the issues that the city faces. You talked about the growing debtors book and the fact that collections have remained weak. We've seen an increase, and I'm sure we can get into that while we talk. But yes, in my view, slowly but surely we'll get there. Look, moving from a declining performance over the years and expecting a quick turnaround is also not realistic in my view. But we need to at least look at the slow progress that we are getting. Because if there's no progress, whether slow or fast, then we have a serious problem on our hands. And that's how we choose to look at it, to say at least there's measurable improvements, even though they're not at the level that we would want. But it clearly shows that whatever we are targeting or we are focusing on, we must continue and we must enhance those initiatives as well.
Well, let me push you on the debtors book, sitting at 73.7, let's call it almost 74 billion rand. How much of that is realistically collectible in the short to medium term, and how much of it should be written off now as simply unrecoverable?
So that's a good question, and that's what we are looking at now, because we also know, just from pure analytical or analyzing data, that not all of that debt is recoverable. A big portion of it also grew during the COVID days and still in our books. And we must be realistic in terms of what's collectible. So you would have seen in the previous two councils, I think the April one approved the debt write-off. And in May, we went with another addendum to the write-off, so that it's not just a blanket write-off. If we come to you as Jeremy and say, look, or you come to us and say, look, I've got a real debt spending back for years, and I had personal issues that I was dealing with, let's write it off, but I can promise to keep into current moving forward. That's what we want to enter into, and that's what the addendum was about, to say, let's have a realistic look at our debtors book, who owes us, how much they owe us, and how long it has been. and write off, and that's the work we are doing. There's a system that we want to implement, similar to what South African Revenue Services have. We've been engaging with them. I would have loved for that system to be live now, because when we first heard about it and engaged on it through the presidency, I thought by now it would be live, but it's not live yet. But it should be going live in the next month, where we have an in-depth look of the customer, who can pay, who can't pay, and why can't they pay, and how do we move. But part of the write-off process is already ongoing, Jeremy, because we are realistic that not the entire 71 is collectible, but what is collectible must be collected, especially from government and big business. But also understanding some of the big businesses took a hit during COVID. The economic climate is also stagnant. So we are working with them to see what is best for both us, the city, and obviously our residents and businesses, so that we can both thrive. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. If you're suggesting that collections are improving, why then is cash coverage still so weak?
So remember, if you've been missing targets over the years, they build up. So, for example, in March, for the first time in this current financial year, we achieved a collection of around 96%. In April, due to the holidays, Easter and the likes, it dropped down to around 88%. But on average, it was still closer to 92%. And we saw that in May and June, we've carried a collection of at least over 90%. So what our discussions is internally and with Treasury is to say, let this not be a short-term improvement in collections. Let's see how we can collect between July and December when we do our midterm assessments. And then we can start saying, Jeremy, we are seeing a slow recovery or a sustained recovery in collections. So we've changed a few things, even in that front, Jeremy.
All well and good.
Collections, yeah.
But right. In reality, residents don't experience ratios or percentages. They experience potholes, outages, billing errors, water interruptions. Why or where is the financial improvement translating into visible service delivery? Because most Johannesburgers would say they're not seeing it.
Look, in terms of water outages, even power, we must also understand, and I think we've been very clear as the city, the backlogs that we face in infrastructure. And if you look at some of the movements that we have done in the current financial year, where we entered an agreement with KfW for electricity and focusing on our network, we are about to close off an agreement with the IFC around water. I mean, those are credible DFIs that are in the market that we would have engaged on, look at the business plans, and they would have done their own due diligence. And I know from a resident point of view, they'll say, look, you are talking a whole lot of financial talk, but that will translate into projects on the ground, with those agreements being placed, with the ability of the city of Johannesburg to draw down that money for the improvement. And we are also quite alive to the fact that our own balance sheet won't be able to cover the infrastructure refurbishments and improvements that we would need for sustained excellent service delivery. And that's why we are also entering the PPP market through GTEC, which is National Treasury. Those processes we are envisaging to close towards September.
Right.
Unfortunately, the PPP process takes a long time. I know the minister has tried to really take out the red tape. But yeah, Jeremy, look, if I were to tell the residents, I'm saying we are moving, we are not stagnant. We are at final stages of some of the contracts, like IFC, some of them we've already signed, and we can then draw down some of those funds which are envisaged for specialized projects, water reservoirs, so that we don't drop the water demand, pipe replacement, all those kind of things. And as the financial head, that's what my focus is, so that the entities can then deliver what they're supposed to deliver.
But realistically, it's going to be many months before residents start to see any kind of improvement. That's what I'm hearing you say.
It will take time.
How much time?
Short-term, medium-term. Look, we've got short-term, medium-term, and long-term. If you think about it, the turnaround of load shedding took years. And it wasn't because people were sitting and not doing anything. It was because they had to start with maintenance, they had to refurbish and the likes. We are in a similar process where I'm talking about raising capital, making sure projects are going live, making sure that we keep to the timelines of those projects so that we can see sustained service delivery. I'm talking about the partnerships that we are entering into, especially on the roads front, potholes, traffic lights, and the likes, so that we residents can see improvements. And I would say the short term, in the next month, 2 months, there will be improvements, even in the next weeks, because we already have a service delivery war room. But ours is to make sure that the future of Johannesburg is solid. Its infrastructure has been refurbished, but we also protect the finances of the city of Johannesburg.
Thank you very much indeed. Teboho Moroka, Group Chief Financial Officer at the City of Johannesburg.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now here's a question. Is South Africa's proposed digital ID system the modern answer to slow, paper-heavy government or the beginning of a surveillance state by stealth? Now critics warn that while digital identity may sound efficient, it could create a permanent record of citizens' interactions, become compulsory in practice and concentrate power in home affairs, and possibly expose South Africans to serious privacy risks. So let's debate this in a little more detail. I'm going to talk now to Ernst Rutz, who is Executive Director of the think tank Lex Libertas. Ernst, welcome. And government says digital ID will reduce fraud and speed up services. What's wrong with that argument?
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds great to say that fraud will be reduced and that services will be sped up, but we're not so convinced that that would be the case. The pursuit of combating fraud is great, but we are concerned that the consequence of this system would simply be that the nature and the scale of fraud would change, and that this system, given the highly centralized nature thereof, and the fact that we are also concerned about security breaches and system maintenance and so forth, would actually open up the door to much more problems, in the sense that previously, if one's information is decentralized, if it's in different places, the damage is fairly limited if your information is stolen. But if it's all in one place, if someone gets access to that information, that person would get access to everything. So that's one of the concerns.
So are you saying then that South Africa should not modernize identity systems at all, or are you suggesting this version is just badly designed?
No, we are very much in favor of modernization and of using new technologies and making things smoother and easier. But there are a few problems with this particular proposal, and the one I have just mentioned. The other is that the Department of Home Affairs is, and government in general, but especially Home Affairs, is notorious for not being able to keep the system online. And the argument here, or the proposal, is to be much more dependent on the system. This type of system, or this kind of idea, would work well in a high-trust society, but South Africa is not a high-trust society, and people in South Africa have particularly low trust in the government and in the Department of Home Affairs. And there have been some examples of large-scale system failures and security breaches at Home Affairs in the past, and we are concerned that a system like this those problems would be exacerbated if it were to be done through a system like this.
So what's a better system then?
Well, I think one aspect thereof is to be very careful about modernizing and centralizing. It sounds great to say that we need to develop and we need to digitize, but we are concerned that in the South African context, the main issue should not so much be on moving towards a different system, but rather on making sure that the current system works properly. Because we are too concerned about, and that is another concern that we have, is we know the South African government, especially through people like the President Cyril Ramaphosa, have made many statements about their admiration for the Chinese model and so forth. This system essentially boils down to a surveillance state infrastructure. I know they wouldn't call it that, but it would certainly create the infrastructure to start implementing something like the social credit score system like they have in China, where if you criticize government, then your score goes down. And if you work with the government or with their program, your score goes up. And then eventually people could get punished for not being, as they would describe it, patriotic enough. In other words, patriotic to the political objectives of the ruling party. It sounds very alarmist, but that is indeed what is happening in China, countries like China. That is indeed what infrastructure like this would enable. And we should also keep in mind that, as I said, the president himself has said that his vision for South Africa is largely shaped and influenced through his conversations with his friend Xi Jinping. So there is enough reason to be concerned.
Are you not straying here into the realm of conspiracy theory? They're just trying to modernize things and make it more efficient, surely.
Yes, well, we are very concerned about this because we are very, and I'm personally also very annoyed by conspiracy theories, and it's very easy to get, you know, caught up into, you know, what would happen and there's some dark force trying to do something. But and we're concerned about the fact that it comes across as conspiracy theory. But it's not really that. There's a few problems, and the one is it's a highly centralized system that would be dependent on the system remaining online, which there's no evidence that it would remain online. The other is it is indeed the fact that every time if you have the digital ID, every time you use your ID, it would be logged, and the government, that's part of the regulations or the proposal, they will keep track of your they will keep a build a log of every time you used your ID, and they would keep it for 7 years. So they would have very easy access, and especially the Director General at Home Affairs.
But isn't the easy access there already? We have biometrics, ID numbers, Rika, Fika, yeah. SARS databases. What new privacy boundary would digital ID actually cross that it couldn't do so already?
So we are very much in favor of using technology and so forth. But the concern here is all of that would be centralized onto one database. And, you know, held by the department. And again, we're not sure that they would be able to keep it safe and that they would be able to keep it online. But if there were to be a security breach, it would not simply be someone gets access to your medical information or your bank accounts, but all of it at once, or at least that is a risk that is built into this. And so if we had this certainty that the system would remain online, that there would not be security breaches, and also that the government would not have some form of a tendency or inclination to try to use it for political purposes, then we would be much more assured that this could be a good system. But under the South African circumstances as we know it today, we are very concerned.
And just very quickly, what would give you that certainty? For instance, if the system were to be independently audited before launch, would that be enough to mollify you?
Yeah, well, I guess it's something like a scale. It's not a case of complete certainty or complete lack of certainty. Our concern is it's not practical given the current circumstances, given who the ruling party is, given who they regard as heroes, as models to be followed, and so forth. So under these circumstances, we don't have that certainty.
Are you not just trying to create or score political points here?
No, we would have loved not to be involved with a fight like this because we have other fights to be involved with. There are other issues that we regard as very important. And we didn't even plan on being involved with this. But we were, in a sense, dragged in, you could say, because of the fact that people who are involved with our organization who contribute feel very strongly about this. And we were, in a sense, flooded with people reaching out to us saying, listen, we're very concerned about this and someone needs to do something.
All right. Ernst Roets, thank you very much indeed. He's the executive director of the think tank Lex Libertas.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's schools may be facing a leadership crisis and one that is hidden in plain sight. A governing body foundation survey is suggesting many public school principals are simply overwhelmed by paperwork with compliance demands and constant pressure, with nearly 6 in 10 ready to leave. Now, this raises a bigger question. Who leads schools then when leaders themselves are burning out? Let's give you a little more perspective on this important issue. I'm in conversation with Marna Jordan, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Governing Body Foundation. Marna, welcome to you. And how serious then is this burnout crisis among principals?
Thank you very much for having me, Jeremy. Yes, it is a matter of urgency. It is a matter of principals feeling overwhelmed. And the big thing is that the administrative burden that is put upon them is of such a nature that they cannot focus on their actual task, like staff support, learner support, curriculum support, and to do what the principal is supposed to do, and that is to lead the school and all its stakeholders. The big thing also is, because one can easily say, but yeah, let's just delegate that duty. We can delegate the duty to another person, but you can never delegate your accountability nor your responsibility. So that makes it hard for them.
Marna, has this not always been an issue for school principals, though? Are you suggesting the administrative burden has in fact become more onerous?
Yes, it has always been. Look, one of your main functions as a principal is indeed to do administrative tasks. However, the way I look at it, ever since COVID, it seems as if everything has just escalated. And I think the problem is we fully understand as the foundation why the department is dependent on a lot of information that they gather. But the thing is, they give very short notice for people to fill in certain forms or send through data or whatever it is that they are asking. And that has, since COVID, it has sort of escalated and it has become more and more. And the big thing is, what happens is that you will find that you will get an instruction from your district office today that says we want XYZ, and then the same day you can find somebody else in another division, another section of the district or the provincial or even the national department that is requiring, and sometimes it overlaps what they are asking. And I think that is very time consuming and it's unnecessary.
When you talk about the XYZ, what type of forms and data are you specifically referring to? What would a principal have to fill in and supply?
Yes, mostly we supply them with data with regards to, obviously, your number of learners that you have in the various grades. They ask you infrastructure questions such as how many classrooms do the school have, how many toilet seats do they have, and all those kind of things. They ask that as well. They would also ask, for example, your subjects, how many learners chooses which subjects when they go into the FET phase. And then sometimes they're just asking you also questions on, for example, the governance function of the SGB. Is it run properly? They will ask at the beginning of a term, you have to complete something that they call, you must tell them whether you are ready to start the, you know, start the school term. And a lot of those information is actually, it's copying things that has already been given, and it should be known to the department. Yeah.
So what do you think this means then for teaching quality in classrooms if, as you're suggesting, the principals have their eye off the ball?
Well, naturally, it will have a negative impact in the sense that it can seem as if the principal is distracted. It can seem as if the principal does not have his or her priorities right. And that causes that schools find themselves in a situation where the leadership is being questioned. And then the teachers also begin to, you know, falter in what they are supposed to do. So it is a vicious circle, actually, that causes this problem. And the big thing is, so much responsibility has been shifted to the school principal, especially also the financial issues. The department has really, in the last 12 months, they have not been paying the money to the schools that they're supposed to pay. So you've got those things as a principal that you need to deal with.
That figure of nearly 6 in 10 principals are wanting to leave, are ready to leave, how accurate is that data? That's worrying.
Yes, it is. Well, look, we must remember it is a survey. The sample group was just over 300 that came from various types of schools. But what is worrying to us as the Governing Body Foundation is the how the principals are mentally dealing with this issue. And I must admit, even to me, I was quite surprised that the percentage was that high. But that is a great worrying factor, because it is often your older principals, or more, you know, not older is maybe not the right word, your more experienced principals that maybe is already 60. And then they say to themselves, why shall I push myself to 65? I don't have the stamina. I don't want to do any of these things anymore.
And Marna Jordan, have you raised this issue with the education departments or the minister's
office?
Yes, we have. And what's the response been?
Yes. Yeah, we have. Well, look, it is a process. I have noted that it seems the department is taking note of what we are saying. There is circulars going out or memorandums going out asking the district and the provincial departments to reconsider whether they really want a survey to be completed. Is it really necessary? So I think we're moving in the right direction, but you can rest assured the Governing Body Foundation will, within our national consultative forum structures, we will, in those structures, we will obviously address this matter and also then ask from the department to give us an action plan on what are they actively going to do, because I don't think they realize. Let me give you an example. National office decides they want to send something out. Then it goes to the provincial department, from the provincial department to the district, from the district to the school. I don't think the top structures realize when it goes, filters through and it reaches the schools, what is the scope of what is being asked, and that it is not so simple as what it might have seemed originally.
All right, Marina Jordan, I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Chief Executive Officer of the Governing Body Foundation.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, fuel price increases are putting fresh pressure on South Africa's taxi industry, one of the country's most important SME sectors and obviously a daily lifeline for millions of commuters. Now, the taxi finance and insurance provider Mobilize has committed something in the region of 15 million rand in targeted fuel relief for owners, with more than 4 million already distributed to over 1,000 taxi owners in KwaZulu-Natal. But obviously this raises the question, is it enough to protect operators, commuters, and local economies from rising transport costs? Chief Executive Officer of Mobilize, Sean Doherty, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks, sir, for talking to me. Maybe just some context first. How severe is the fuel price squeeze on taxi owners right now? Must be getting very, very difficult to operate.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Yes, it is. It's incredibly difficult to operate. You know, we know that at their peak from the beginning of the year, diesel was up 57%, petrol up north of 20%. Obviously, some of that has, unfortunately, has to be passed on to passengers or commuters. So fares are up. I've seen fares up anywhere from 22 to 45%, depending on the route. So it is. People are being squeezed, and you'll obviously notice that the fare increase actually doesn't cover just the fuel increase. And we know interest rates have gone up. We know where inflation is. So they are struggling at the moment.
Do you do any modeling, Sean, which says or gives you a point at which a taxi route becomes commercially unviable because of fuel costs? And if you have we maybe reached that point already on certain routes?
So, Jeremy, we do, absolutely. And what we see at the moment is, it's actually exactly what you say. There are certain routes, there are certain associations, potentially, and there are certain regions where it is unviable to earn money on those routes. Obviously, if someone has finance in their taxi versus it's paid off, that is a little bit different. But we absolutely see that. And consequently, we see in how many loans we originate a month, they are down because whilst demand is there, we know that certain of these guys on certain routes just can't make it.
Are you able to give us a sense of what those routes are, either within the Gauteng area or nationally?
So, I'll give you generalizations because obviously this is very, very specific. But as an example, the Eastern Cape as a region, and this is a very general comment, but as a region, is really, really struggling. Of all the provinces in the country, all the regions in the country, that one is the most hit. Gauteng, again, generally, is sort of okay, but there definitely are routes. I wouldn't want to quote the specific routes, but we can see it in our data.
But at some point when fares rise, as you've already indicated, the real consequence is for commuters who have no alternative transport option. That, of course, has a broader knock-on effect on productivity, particularly regarding the place to where they are heading to work.
It's 100% right. I know it is a slightly different topic, but we obviously had the disruption of the marches.
Yeah.
I mean, we also know that our commuters don't have massive alternatives. And we also know that they spend an inordinate amount of money on travel in terms of percentage of their salary. So it absolutely has knock-on impacts and all of them bad.
And Sean, your company is committed, as I said a little earlier, 15 million rand in fuel relief. And my understanding of that, 4 million to 1,000 taxi owners in KZN. Why start there, and what have you learnt so far from that intervention?
So, Jeremy, look, it is a little bit more than 4 million rand across the country. So you are right, it is 15 million rand over 3 months. What we have done, and it's not regional, or it's not specific to certain routes or anything. What we have done is we've looked at our customer base, and we've looked at certain behaviors, whether those are driving behaviors or whether they are payment behaviors. We obviously know that this macro event is a massive shock, and we see it in the data where people have been trying and then slowly but surely are starting to slip. So we've chosen those clients to provide this relief to try to help them through the next few months. It obviously, I guess the timing of it maybe has caught people's attention, but it's something we've been doing for, quite frankly, years. It's not always monetary incentives, but there are different ways to try to experiment and help these SMEs in ways which are maybe a little bit different to a traditional financial institution would do. And then when those work, we operationalize them. When they don't, we obviously move on to the next experiment. But so 4 million to 1,000 customers in KZ, and I think that's just one stat, Jeremy. It's way more many thousand than that. And as I say, it'll be 15 million over three months.
And Sean, I need to ask this question. What is Mobilize gain from this intervention? And how do you avoid it being seen just as reputational protection rather than support for the sector?
So what we see, and look, I mean, in fairness, like what we've experienced and the taxi sector's experienced, not just our business, any other person who's financing taxis saw, when people start to slip into arrears and that arrears starts to compound, obviously, with interest, at some point, people give up. I mean, that is what happens. We see it. We see it in a number of ways. So where we have customers who are willing to pay, sometimes not able, but willing, and again, we can see that in the data, we are trying to find mechanisms and ways to support them through various shocks. I mean, this shock, obviously, it's macro, so everybody is aware of it. But, I mean, it's not too long ago where there were floods out in Nelspruit, which was more of a micro event. So we are trying to get those guys not to slip into arrears, or if they slip into arrears, not to slip too much, such that they can have a sustainable business and pay us back over the sort of term of their loan. So what we get is we get a client who is sustainable. If that client is sustainable, they will pay us back, and ultimately they'll probably come and take another loan from us. So it's not just about inverted commas supporting the sector. We very much are trying to support our clients so we can be sustainable ourselves.
And just finally and quickly, if fuel prices remain high, and there's every indication that they will, surely something needs to change in the taxi business model to keep owners viable and, more importantly, commuters moving.
I think you're 100% right. Now, and if you just think about, I guess, any business, you probably have two big lines you have to worry about. You know, one is revenue and the other is expenses. So if we assume, as you say, that fuel doesn't decrease, like, is there another way of fueling it, a taxi? So, I mean, everyone does talk about EVs. Everyone does talk about gas. That might be an alternative.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen overnight. Maintenance, if you do regular maintenance, and you drive slower, you will spend less fuel. So as opposed to react to an event, which is what a lot of people do, and maintain your vehicle properly, it will lower your maintenance costs. If you're driving slower, and if you are driving maybe in inverted commas more responsibly, accident frequency will go down. If accident frequency goes down, insurance premiums go down. So et cetera. So those things have to be looked at. Importantly, different vehicles for different routes must be looked at. So there are certain routes which maybe don't require a Toyota Cessna Kile, which is a 600,000 rand vehicle. Maybe it is an alternative. There are certain routes which require a 7-seater car. So people have to start to look at that. And importantly, on the top line, the utilization of the asset needs to be thought of differently. You know, these vehicles are probably sitting idle 15 hours a day. It's a lot of money to have sitting there doing nothing. So are there mechanisms, and we're doing experiments on these as an example, are there mechanisms to use these for delivery of goods, maybe in a last mile sort of delivery scenario. And there are companies doing those sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, there are companies doing, as an example, Wi-Fi and taxis, which does increase top line. So there are, I think you're right, so they have to look at these things differently. And also the most successful taxi operators we see generally are, obviously, they're small businesses, but they're slightly bigger than the norm. So they're not one or two taxis. They'll tend to have a small fleet of taxis. They'll tend to be in other logistics businesses, and therefore they can survive the shocks as they come. But ultimately, the whole model needs to be looked at. I guess the question of subsidization needs to be right. Needs to be thought of as well. And subsidization can come in all sort of ways and forms. But you are right; the model would not be sustainable if prices carry on going the way they are.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. Sean Doherty, who's Chief Executive Officer of Mobilize. It's a taxi finance and insurance provider. And on that note, we will leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.